We hope you find this WILL podcast to be valuable. A $10 voluntary credit card contribution at willpledge.org will help us continue to make podcasts of our programs available. Thank you. And that address again is willpledge.org. WILLPLEDGE.ORG. Now here's your program.
From WILL, Illinois Public Media, this is Focus. Good morning, I'm Celeste Quinn. The program's producers are Harriet Williamson and Martha Deal. Our technical director is Henry Frain. The notice was short and it was delivered in a hallway. Lee Kravitz had been fired. A workaholic, he had never given a thought to being without a job. The question, what are your plans, and the realization he didn't have any, unnerved him. Then he realized, while he was out of a job, he had plenty of work to do. Lee Kravitz tells the story of his epiphany in his book Unfinished Business, One Man's Extraordinary Year of Trying to Do the Right Things. In the book's prologue, he says this, "It's ironic. We consign our most essential business to the bottom of our to-do list because we lack the time and energy to do the things that matter most in our lives well." He also says this, "If one can attend to these things, great rewards will follow." Listeners, join the discussion by phone or by email. I look forward to your questions and comments. The number in the Champaign-Urbana area is 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. Our toll-free number is 800-222-9455, 800-222-WILL. And our email address is will-talk@illinois.edu. Lee Kravitz is an award-winning journalist who was most recently editor-in-chief of Parade magazine. He grew up in Cleveland and attended Yale and Columbia universities. His book, Unfinished Business, is published by Bloomsbury. 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455, will-talk@illinois.edu. Lee Kravitz, welcome. How are you?
I'm great. Great to be here, Celeste.
Nice to talk with you this morning. Being fired wasn't totally unexpected. Your wife, Elizabeth, had suggested maybe it was time to leave the job. Nonetheless, when the day came, you were stunned. Why?
Well, I think it's always hard when you get the news. And I got the news in a very summarily way in a hallway. It was in a one-minute conversation. Even though my relationship with my boss had suffered in the last year, we had had a lot of affection in our relationship. We'd worked well together. It was definitely on the downswing. And so when I got the news, I felt what everybody, I think, feels when they're laid off or they're suddenly find out that they've been terminated. I felt angry. I felt manipulated, betrayed. And worried not only by the fact that I no longer had a job, but worried about whether I'd be able to find another one and provide for my children, my three young children.
Yeah.
So those are very, very common feelings, and I had those. And my wife said, "This will be the best thing that ever happened to you," and that felt great for about 3 seconds. And 2 weeks later, it still didn't feel that way.
Yeah. You say fear and compulsion kept you chained to that job. Do you suspect that's true for a lot of people?
I think for most of us, we have fears of a lot of things. We have fears of dealing with the nitty-gritty of our life, our emotional life, our spiritual life. We have fears of losing a job. We have fears of not having the identity that a job supplies to us. When I was working, when many people are working, you become your role. Yeah, that's how you walk in the world. That's how you comport yourself. That's how you relate to other people through the title, and there's a fear of losing that. On the compulsion side, well, I was a workaholic, and, you know, there's a desire to do a great job. And then there's the urgency that we all face of deadlines, of get this done now. And that can become so important that we sight of some of the more really important, truly important things in our lives, such as family and friends and the values that we hold most dear.
In the book's second chapter, you tell the story of renewing a friendship. Your friend, Andrei Barhamovich's daughter, Andy, had been killed in Iraq, and you hadn't sent him a note of condolence. And you write, "I had every intention of doing so, but I allowed doubts and deadlines to get in my way."
Yeah, the doubts were really, I hadn't seen him in 40 years. I was afraid he wouldn't remember me. I was afraid of intruding on his grief. Who was I, someone from his past, to enter his life all of a sudden at a moment of such deep tragedy? And of course there was the one, as I wrote out all those condolence cards one after the other for about 3 days and tore them up, There was that feeling that whatever I wrote, it would be trivial given the magnitude of what had happened to him.
Yeah.
And so when the deadline started up again, you know, I was editor-in-chief of Parade. We had to get out every week. My art director would come in on Monday and tell me that he needed headlines, otherwise they couldn't design the stories in the publication. All of a sudden, I was back in the race to get to my deadlines, to not miss them. And it was a year and a half before I actually paid that condolence call to Andre, when I had committed myself to completing my unfinished business, unfinished emotional and spiritual business. I saw him face to face, and I forgot to mention the deepest fear. We were talking about fear before. There was one that was even deeper than the ones I had mentioned to you. There was a fear of something happening to my own 13-year-old daughter. I was afraid to even let my mind go there. But when I saw Andre, we didn't talk about my daughter or his daughter. All we talked about was baseball, because we'd been on the same baseball team 40 years before that won an Ohio State championship, and our total conversation had to do with where was he now? You know, did he ever make it to the pros? What was it like during that game? Why did our coach treat us so badly? All those recollections. And I think by talking about baseball, I gave him a vacation from grief, and he gave me so much, turned out to give me so much more in terms of friendship over the course of the last couple of years.
Yeah. It seems to me, in reading your book, Unfinished Business, that in order to take care of unfinished business, you are required to be truly with someone. You're required to be present. Looking back on it, you call it being alert. Did that take practice?
It didn't take practice so much as giving myself the time to be with someone, and also going into whatever conversation with openness, with an open heart. And it also meant being a listener and not simply a talker. You know, too often when we meet up with someone after a long time, we're so full of words. Boom, 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 want to bring everybody up today. We want to make our amends. We have our own agenda. And yet the really valuable stuff, the great rewards, come when you listen to another human being. And face-to-face isn't necessarily the way you have to do it. You can do it through email or on a phone call. But face-to-face, it seemed when I actually was with someone that there was almost a womb of quiet around us. And I was just focused on only that other person. And that person, be it a friend or a relative I hadn't seen in a long time, or someone who I had wronged, or someone who I needed to pay a debt back to, or I'd made a promise to that I didn't fulfill, whoever it was, I found myself really alert to their body language, their uniqueness as a human being, what they were trying to say to me. And I think that's where the great, great experience we have with other people happens when we listen.
Yeah. And if you're on the telephone, you have to do the same thing. If you're talking by email, also you really have to be, maybe you're not face-to-face, maybe you're not in audio contact with that other individual, but you have to devote yourself to the task at hand.
Yeah, and pay attention to what that person is saying. And realize that the end of a sentence is not the end of a conversation. There are questions to be asked, ideas to be probed, sentiments to be tendered towards another person, whether it's when you're talking to them on a phone, when you're writing them an email, when you're face-to-face with them.
You report that by reaching out to Andre in his suffering, in his grief over the death of his daughter, you came away with a richer relationship with your father. That's one of the things that happened in the course of renewing this friendship. Would you tell us the story?
Yeah, it was really remarkable because, again, Andre and I had played on a baseball team together. And I had one, and my father had been my coach, not on this particular team, but growing up. I'd always had a tense relationship with him, partly because he was one of these fathers who was really hard driving, particularly when it came to sports. So much so that when Andre and I were playing on this very competitive Sandlot baseball team, my father, when I was pitching, would stand behind the backstop. And he'd say to me, throw the big one, throw the big one, which meant the curveball. Now, of course, the problem with your father standing behind the backstop and shouting that out loud is that everybody in the ballpark knew what I'd throw if I obeyed him, which I often did. Well, finally, the coach got so angry at my father that he banned him to the parking lot. My father couldn't even attend the game, but you could see my father sitting on the hood of the car, motioning with his arm, throw the big one, throw the big one. So at the time that I again began to have, renew my friendship with Andre, he urged me, Andre, who had been a baseball and football coach in high school and was now a phys ed teacher in an elementary school in Painesville, Ohio, Andre urged me to become the Little League coach of my children. You know, my sons who were 11 and 9 at the time. And I had really tried not to put myself in the same position that my father was in with me as coaching a son. But Andre said, not only will you enjoy it, it's the right thing for you, but your father, it'll be meaningful to him. And sure enough, Andre was my mentor for my becoming a Little League coach. He told me what drills to do. He was a sounding board for me as a coach. And after every game, I would write my father an email reporting on how my sons, his grandsons, had done, and they'd done well, but also on my coaching decisions. You know, when I'd done something and really screwed up and felt bad about it, when I'd done something that seemed to work. And all of a sudden, my father and I had a conversation going every week about baseball. And my heart began to soften toward him. And when he'd give me advice in emails, I'd actually listen to them. By the end of this experience, I found myself drawing closer to my father and becoming more compassionate to him, which was really surprising to me, that I'd gone into this situation, this piece of unfinished business with my friend Andre to say, I'm sorry for the loss of your child. And I came out of it with a much closer, softer relationship with my own father.
Mm. This is Focus. Good morning. I'm Celeste Quinn. Our guest today, Lee Kravitz, in this portion of the program. He's the author of Unfinished Business, One Man's Extraordinary Year of Trying to Do the Right Things. You're invited to join the discussion this morning with a phone call or by email, 333-9455, the number in the Champaign-Urbana area, toll-free 800-222-9455. and the email address will-talk@illinois.edu. Well, you said your dad was a hard-driving guy. Apparently, you come from a long line of workaholics.
I do. It goes back to Russia, when my family of peasants used to work in the field, get up as early as they could in the morning. They didn't believe in education, oddly enough. I've had a great education, but I'm the first person in my family who really got one. My family believed that hard work was the key, and that's what life was all about. And they worked so hard. Most of them died in their they got their first heart attacks in their late 20s, early 30s, and died in their 50s and 60s. Didn't take great care of themselves. So I come from a hard-driving family. They, when they came to this country, they channeled their energies into crime. You know, it was common for immigrants. They ended up in Cleveland selling sugar to bootleggers and try to use their wits to make a living. And that and they kept working hard at crime, hard at whatever they did.
You say once a workaholic, always a workaholic. So how do you now work at balance?
Well, I think that I am. There's no question that I'll always be one who is driven to work. I spent my year away from work writing a book, which is a form of a book, which is a form of work. But there's been a big shift because my year of taking care of my unfinished business was, at its core, a year of resetting my priorities to seeing that balance in my life was crucial to becoming a better father, husband, son, friend. So it takes discipline each and every day for me to not fall into my old work habits. That means every day I take stock of what's important that day. You know, not just to be after getting fired and having a year to do it. I take stock every day. I try to move quickly on the things that are important. I return emails and phone calls a lot quicker. If I'm with someone who I love or who means something to me, I let them know that now. There's too many instances in my life that I became aware of where I waited and waited or said, I'll tell them later, and then later it never came. You know, the person died, the person left. Now I have this sense that each day has more urgency to it. I don't bite off more than I can chew as much. I used to always have big dreams, big plans, big ambitions. I think I'm a little more... Let's say that I've discovered the beauty and necessity of scale, that when I undertake a project, I weigh it not only according to what good can come of the project, but its effect on my family and my relationships, my health.
Yeah.
So those are some of the ways.
Yeah. I want to come back to that idea of scale, but first let's take a call from a listener. Calling in this morning from Schaumburg, line 4. Hi.
Hey, good morning. I wanted to say afternoon. It feels like afternoon to me for some reason. You know, I'm glad you're doing that, and it sounds like, and I kind of did the same thing. In such strife right now, it's hard to keep an upbeat attitude with all the chaos out there. And I mean, I lost my dad last year. I lost my neighbor last year, I think 3 days after I got back. I've lost friends since then, passed away. And I'm seeing people lose their house, their livelihood, and all this other chaos. But you know what? Even with me, I'm not really working like I used to. I've got 3 out of the 5 or 4 out of the 5, 7 days I'm not working. Mm-hmm. But, you know, I can't. Life is too short. I look at it this way. If I die, I die. You know, that you ever see that movie, The Bucket List?
I haven't seen it, no.
I'm checking out stuff I want to do. You know, whether it costs money or not, I'm going to do some of this stuff because, you know, the way the political scheme is now and the way we have no control over it, the way life in general is, we're so complicated. And that's a big thing with me. It's just complications. This program's great and full of knowledge,
mm-hmm.
but it's like, what do you do with it? Unless you use it properly, you know, whether it's by the brain or physically doing it, you know, you're not changing your life. Go out and do something. Go do something for other people. My big thing is to pay it forward bit. Let's pay everybody forward. Instead of being, you know, when things are slow, when you get in traffic and it's slow and you can't get anywhere, instead of cutting somebody off and flipping the finger and being stupid, let's slow down. You know, life's too short. You're going to get there eventually, right?
Well, I think you've made some really profound points. First of all, the notion of, you know, there's some things we can control in our life, but it's not sort of the big scheme of thing. It's these little things like our relationships with other people, the fact that we can be kind to other people each and every day, choose to be kind. The fact, as you say, of doing stuff for other people and not simply for ourselves. Each of those actions, no matter how terrible what's going on outside, and you've faced a lot of horrible stuff over the years, a lot of Americans have, because of the economy or just the cycle of life. But if you make choices to act in ways that are uplifting, you yourself can be uplifted. And I think what you've just shared with listeners and with me is very profound in that way.
Does a listener want to follow up?
My life with my wife and my family, and you know, the Lord God, you know, Jesus Christ. And I don't want to say I'm completely religious about this, but I tell people keep the faith, even if you're not religious, you keep the faith. Yeah, you know, the thing is, the ironic thing, I hear a lot of people that are smart people not believing in something. You know, they may believe in other people, but they don't believe in themselves.
Right.
And if you don't believe in yourselves, what good are you? You look at yourself in the mirror every day and say, I'm good. I'm better than the next guy. Even though you fail, that's what life's about. My dad taught me this. And it took me till I'm 54 now. I'm starting to realize a couple years ago. But I still don't know what I want to be, by the way. But anyway, I appreciate you guys. I appreciate Celeste and David and everybody that puts these programs on. I've donated. Even though I don't have all the money I need to, I've put even a couple, 10, 20 bucks in the mail and sent it to you guys. I love you guys. Keep up the good work. I hope you get more programming because this is what it's about. Thank you.
Thanks for the call this morning. Anything else there, Lee, before we talk about something else?
No, I think that he's expressing, the listener's expressing something that so many people feel. In hard times, how do we maintain a sense of our own worth? And I think we have so many people losing their jobs, for instance, now. And when they lose their jobs, they feel like it's the end of the world. Well, it's not the end of the world. You've lost your job, and there's going to be a struggle back to finding a job and of course, feeding your family and providing for opportunities for your kids. But the job is not you. It's never you. When I was editor-in-chief of Parade Magazine, which was a very big job, sometimes, you know, I thought of it too much as being my identity in the world. When I lost it, I realized that job was not me.
Mm.
There's something much deeper. There's something more human. There's something... and so my year of getting back in touch with people who knew me when I was a teen or in my 20s and 30s just reinforced to me that that job was just a chapter in my life, that there were qualities of me, passions, that went way beyond what I just lost.
333-9455, 800-222-9455, will-talk@illinois.edu, if you'd like to join our discussion this morning. Lee Kravitz is our guest. He's the author of Unfinished Business, One Man's Extraordinary Year of Trying to Do the Right Things. When you were talking with our caller just a moment ago, I was reminded of the chapter about Andre. And you quote Wordsworth in this chapter, that best portion of a good man's life, his little, nameless, unremembered acts of kindness and love.
I have always gone back to that idea that it's in the small acts of goodness that we do, the choices that we make each day, that we are most profoundly human. I'm reminded of it every day. You know, the way anybody, when you feel, when you've extended yourself, not because you're getting something out of it, just because it's the right thing to do.
Mm.
And I get touched more than anything when I witness, when I'm witness to another person acting in a kind way. It could be helping someone across the street. It could be talking to a child in a way that that encourages that child to do something wonderful. It could be seeing someone who's elderly or handicapped in some form and just extending a kindness. Those actions touch me to see people do those in every day,
yeah.
Every single day.
Yeah. I'm also reminded now of Calvin Trillin's book, Messages from My Father.
Mm.
And Mr. Trelinski, I believe that was the family's name, told his son over and over again, you might as well be a mensch.
Mensch is a beautiful Yiddish word. It's wonderful. And if the world were full of, if everyone was a mensch, this would be a much, much, much better world. If you were generous to other people, if you thought of others first rather than yourself. Most of us, that's not our first instinct. I don't think we're necessarily taught that. Maybe it's not even human nature to be that way. But what a beautiful thing when we encounter a mensch. There are a lot of mensches in my life, and I treasure every one of them.
Yeah, I love that word, too. And so often, you know, I think to myself, on a bad day, you know, that's what I say. Might as well be a mensch. Get out there. Do something.
And you probably feel better being a mensch if it turns out
So
bad a day.
And it makes me smile just remembering Calvin Trillin and his father and the way he deadpanned that you might as well be a mensch.
Might as well. Wonderful, wonderful image there.
At the top of the list of unfinished business was locating your Aunt Fern. You'd last heard from her on your 33rd birthday. Tell us about her.
Well, my Aunt Fern was the relative I was closest to growing up and into my 20s and 30s. She was my father's sister. She's a very sensitive person. When she was young, she trained to be a classical pianist. We would share secrets with each other. She was always very encouraging to me. She had unconditional love for me. She was also paranoid schizophrenic, who spent a lot of her life in institutions. And when I lost my job, I spent a good period of time going through old artifacts from my life, letters, photographs, and I came across a birthday card she had sent me when I was 33, and it reminded me of how much she loved me. It also reminded me of the fact that I hadn't seen her since 1995. She had been living with my grandmother at the time. My grandmother had Alzheimer's. Fern was, as I said, a paranoid schizophrenic. They couldn't take care of themselves, let alone each other, so they kept getting into physical altercations. One got a little serious. The police came and institutionalized Vern again. And when I surfaced 15 years later or 14 years later, having lost my job, I realized, where's Fern?
Mm.
And I asked around my relatives, and no one seemed to know. And they also didn't seem to care. There was a sense that Fern was somewhere in some institution, but it was not our obligation to be with her. And in fact, if we saw her, it might summon up memories that would be sad for her and lead her to contemplate suicide, as she had done so many times before. But I thought to myself, this is a woman who loved me so deeply. She's alive, and I haven't, and I don't know where she is. And she's on the earth somewhere. And I need to find her to show her that I care, but also to show myself that I'm the type of person who cares about other people. And so finally I did find her. And I found her maybe in a senior care facility, special care facility about 30 minutes outside of Cleveland, where she'd grown up and I'd grown up. And, you know, I went in with great trepidation, didn't think that I'd be given the opportunity to talk to her. But I just wanted to know if she was okay. And the social worker there said, I see no reason why you can't see her. And I'll always remember the moment when I was waiting in the hallway as a nurse wheeled her out of the dining room. And as Fern approached me, I thought, she'll never remember me. And instead I heard her yell out, Lee Richard Kravitz, my brilliant nephew. And then she shouted so that everyone could hear, Lee Richard Kravitz is here to see me, everyone. Give me a hug, Lee Richard.
Mm-hmm.
And then I hugged her, and it was such, it must have gone on for 10 minutes. She said, don't let me go. I never thought I'd see you again.
Mm-hmm.
And I never thought I'd see her again. It was the deepest, most profound hug that I'd ever experienced, and I really felt the weight fall off my shoulders. I felt the guilt fall off my shoulders. I felt that feeling I'd never see her again fall off my shoulders. And in place, I felt light. You know, I felt empathetic again. I felt like I was that person who cared.
Mm. Would you please read an excerpt from that chapter, Lee?
Sure. Let me just turn to something.
I was so moved by this.
Yeah. You know, when I saw Fern, she really, you have to remember that she hadn't been visited by anyone. Any relative in
for 14 years,
and had only one visitor who was a non-relative, and only for a few months. And here I'll read from the chapter. Finally, she said, "I don't know where I am, Lee Richard. I don't know where I am." Fern had been at Aurora Manor for 14 years, and no one had told her where she was in terms that made sense to her. I said that she was in a special care facility in Aurora, Ohio. It was almost half an hour away from the house where she grew up. She was even closer to the apartment she had shared with her mother and Jerry, who was her ex-husband, in Beechwood. Aurora Manor was just down the road from Geauga Lake Amusement Park, whose giant roller coaster had scared Fern when she was a kid. And she was only 2 miles away from Mount Olive Cemetery, where Jerry was buried. Thank you, Lee Richard, she said. Thank you for telling me where I am. I lit another cigarette for her. She told me how lonely she was, how she missed her mother, her brothers, and Jerry. She said then she had written 6 letters to 3 governors of Ohio requesting that they allow her to leave. No one had written her back. I'm a prisoner, Lee Richard, a prisoner, she said. And no one remembers my birthday, Lee Richard. Not Harry, not Pudgy, not anyone. November the 4th comes and goes, and no one calls or sends me a card. A plane flew by. Fern looked up and then cowered as if she were afraid of getting bombed. I took out a photograph I had brought of my three children and Pip, our dog. "These are your nephews, Benjamin and Noah," I said. "We named Benjamin after Grandpa Benny. And here's your niece. Her name is Caroline. Isn't she pretty? And this is Pip, our dog. He's much better behaved than Buffy." Buffy was her dog. "Buffy," she laughed, "my bad dog, Buffy." Fern took the photograph and asked me what each of my children liked to do. I told her that Ben and Noah played baseball and the violin and that Caroline rode horses and played piano. When I said that she could keep the photo, she clutched it to her heart. It was nearly time for me to catch my plane. I walked a mile with pleasure. She chatted all the way, but I was none the wiser. I couldn't believe my ears. Fern was reciting the poem that she had inscribed on the card she sent me on my 33rd birthday. Did she remember writing, "It's a long story, someday we'll write it together," on that card? Again, I was too stunned to ask. "What a beautiful poem," I told her, "and you said it beautifully with so much heart." "Thank you," she said. It was time for me to go. This had been one of the most extraordinary hours of my life, and I had gotten far more out of seeing Fern than simply righting my original wrong. I had helped Fern locate her place in the world in a way that made sense to her. But she had done the same for me. Fern brought out the part of me that acted selflessly and cared for those closest to me. It was a part of myself that I didn't see often enough. "I need to go," I said, realizing that I would be back as soon as I could to see her. "Don't leave, Lee Richard," she said. "I have to," I said, "but I'll be back soon. I promise."
And the promise was kept.
And the promise was kept. And, in fact, I've been back many, many, many times since then and will whenever I have a chance. I live in New York, and, of course, she's in Cleveland. But it was kept in such a way that on her next birthday, November 4th, I organized a birthday party for her at Aurora Manor. And a couple of relatives came, and it was this beautiful event. I put together an album of old pictures for her, and then she requested that the nurse wheel her to the piano. And remember, she'd been a concert-level pianist, and then over the years she had not played the piano. And then she sat at that piano, and even though she was rusty, she played some of the songs that I'd loved when I was growing up, Yiddish songs, songs from musicals like Sound of Music and Carousel. And it was just this beautiful, wonderful moment. She was happy. I was happy. I think everyone in that place was happy that day.
Yeah. Well, this goes back to the idea of scale, I think. You mentioned earlier that you've had to rethink plans and ambitions. And here we have a story of some small gestures, really, that are just tremendous.
I think that these are the small gestures we can all make and take each and every day, if we're alert to them, if we're conscious of them. And also, you know, part of it comes from just this sense that life, as the caller said before, is short. It is so short, and what we do each day has an urgency to it. And to put off those kindnesses till later makes no sense at all, because later may never come. And so along with living a life of better scale, I think I'm living a life that takes place now more, right now, when I feel an instinct to do something, a good instinct, a positive instinct, I'm a lot more prone to do it.
Yeah. Well, now I'd like to talk a little bit about Caroline, your daughter. And the last chapter is about scale.
Yes.
And she, ultimately, she helped you with this piece of unfinished business. Would you tell us what happened?
Right. when I was an editor, even before Parade, when I was editorial director at a company called Scholastic, which is a large educational publishing company, I had big projects. And I went around the world trying to make those projects into reality. And wherever I was, I had a sense that I could make something big happen. So when I was in a refugee camp in northern Kenya in 1993, it was a refugee camp called Kakuma, where there were 35,000 children who had been orphaned from the tribal wars in Somalia and Ethiopia. I met one boy who struck me in particular because he was so avid to get to America and make something of his life, and he was so curious, such a wonderful kid. And he took me into the town, the refugee camp's new library, and was showing it off to me, and I noticed there were only three or four books in it. And all those books, which he had been learning English from, were from 1945, when the British still ruled Kenya. And so I, being editorial director of this big publishing company, said to him, I'm going to fill this library with books. And he looked at me with a look that said, no, you won't. People are always making that type of promise and not doing it. And I said, but I will, I will. And, of course, I go back to New York thinking I'm going to just arrange a plane through the U.N., and get 1,000 books from Scholastic and fill that library of books and be the great hero and bring promise and hope to this boy's life. And I found out that, oh, my God, it's much more complicated than I could ever have imagined. Logistically, all the red tape I'd have to go through. And then once again, deadlines took over, life took over, and I didn't fulfill my promise to that boy. Well, I didn't think much about that until I lost my job at Parade and started to think about my unfinished business and saw material that was from that time in my life in that refugee camp. Then all of a sudden I realized, boy, that was a big deal. I didn't fulfill a promise to that child. What a jerk I was. The funny thing was that of all the many, the 10 items of unfinished business I chose to address during that year, this one I kept postponing, the idea of filling that library with books. And it wasn't until my year was almost over that I realized, you know why, it's just too big. You know, for me, I could go about spending 3, 4, 5, 6 months trying to make this happen. But what would I lose in the process? I would have to be away from my family, my kids. I've got to stop biting off these big, big projects. Well, it was my daughter who came up with the solution that I could live with and which really taught me the lesson of scale. We were sitting around right before Thanksgiving. You know how you get these letters of solicitation in the mail from different charities and causes. We probably had 50 of them. And I gave each of our children, 3 children, $100. And their task was to choose the charities they wanted to become philanthropists to and support. So they'd open up the letters, advocate the causes, and so on. Mm. And it was a wonderful tradition and ritual to begin and do. But then I told the story of the boy in the library, and my daughter said, well, Dad, why don't we just, you know, send one box of books over. We'll go to different bookstores and through our own library, and we'll think about what books might be of use to them, and we'll just put together a box and send it over. You know, she wanted to do that because she wanted to help that boy, who's now a man. And she felt that gesture to help those in need. And she'd come up with a solution that made sense in the scale of our life.
Mm-hmm.
And I realized then that's when the idea of scale really, really hit me, that going forward, I would not personally undertake projects that would take me from my family, but projects to help the world that would involve my family.
Yeah. Well, your daughter also helped you.
Oh, she helped me a lot in this regard. She helped me to see a truth. And it also, just to give you some perspective, and I think a lot of workaholics could relate to this, I was the type of father who, if you looked at my family, you might say, oh, he's a great father because he does go to their games and he's at home a lot. But when I was there, I wasn't present. I was thinking about work. I always had work on my mind. You know, I was in another place. And my kids recognize that.
Yeah.
They would say, Daddy, you know, never smiles, or Daddy, you know, they'd be afraid to approach me to help them with their homework. But by the end of this year, and in the final chapter of the book, I'm sitting there helping my daughter with a research paper.
Yeah.
And I'm there for her at that moment. I'm really there. I'm thinking about what she needs to succeed at getting this done, not about hurrying through it or... I was really present. There was nothing that could have been more important to me.
Yeah. I laughed because I recall from the book, you tell a tale on yourself that in order to do your work, you would do preemptive strikes in terms of chores so that your wife would kind of let you do your work.
Yeah, get her off my back.
Yeah.
I can do it. If I could do the minimum and could do it in a very cosmetic way, say wash the dishes or bring a roll of toilet paper up to the bathroom upstairs without her asking me, I would. It was almost like a deflection. then I'd earn myself work.
I deserve that cookie now.
I deserve right. And my cookie was this.
Was work.
Work, 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 work. And the problem when you're working all the time or thinking about it is you're just not attuned to all the really important and wonderful stuff going around you. You just aren't.
What do Elizabeth and the children think of the book?
Well, I think they like the book. My youngest son, Elizabeth, really likes the book as a book. And likes the fact that I've become a more present husband and father, although she also says there's a lot more work you can need to do, to be honest. She's a very honest person. My youngest kid has, the 10-year-old read the book. He was the first reader of it. He took it the second I got a copy of it. He took it and read it, and I was a little... I was a little worried about what he'd think. You know, it's a very honest and in some places raw book. But he, I think, got it. He felt loved. I think the way I wrote about him, I think they take pride in the fact that their dad stuck with this book and got it done, and that the book was in some way about them and me getting closer to them. So... I think they, you know, they're teenagers now, my two oldest, age 13, so they don't say a lot about such things. But I think they've gone to a couple of my readings and sat in the audience, and I could detect a smile or two.
Yeah. Speaking of readings, you recently finished a tour with a book that took you from the East Coast to the West Coast with a couple of stops here in the Midwest. Tell us about the interactions that you had with people who came to the readings. What were the conversations like?
Well, what interested me is that I did very little reading, maybe a tiny bit, told the story of the book, and then it became almost an encounter group where people would share their stories of unfinished business. And in some cases, a lot of people would cry when they shared their stories. There were some profound conversations that I really enjoyed and learned from. A number of people, I think almost at every reading, a couple people had lost jobs. They came to those readings. And so the notion that your job is not who you are was something I think that uplifted them. I think everybody, at every reading, there were people who had lost touch with someone important in their life, be it a relative or a friend. And they'd talk about that person, and they'd make a pledge almost on the spot to reach out to that mm-hmm. person, knowing that it might not be as hard as they had thought to extend their hand, to be open to that other person, to say, I'm sorry, or I've missed you, or I love you. So that was very gratifying. There were questions that came up that really made me think about if I were ever in the position that I'd have to advise people. You know, a lot of people said that when they have tried to make amends to others, they have been not well met. You know, there hasn't been the receptivity that I got from my people. So I've been thinking about that and thinking a lot about ways that you can make amends so that people be receptive, and also what happens if it's just not going to happen, how you can't force something that isn't meant to be. You've got to find your own peace with it. So I kept learning along the way. It was wonderful. I really enjoyed all the readings.
Well, I enjoyed reading the book, and I have so enjoyed talking with you this morning.
Well, this has been a wonderful experience for me, too.
Well, take care, and the best to your family.
And thank you.
Lee Kravitz has been our guest in this portion of Focus. He is the author of Unfinished Business, One Man's Extraordinary Year of Trying to Do the Right Things. The book is published by Bloomsbury.